Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Gun violence in America. Indianapolis reels from a deadly mass shooting at a FedEx facility as body cam video of the police shooting of a Chicago teen is released. Then, a growing trend. Dozens of states across the country are seeking to ban young transgender athletes from competition, despite widespread public opposition. Plus, it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart look at the national divide on police use of force and the president's plan to withdraw all troops from Afghanistan. And making their voices heard. After decades of being shunned by the industry, black women finally gained prominence in country music.
There's already the issue of women not necessarily getting the same airplay as male artists. Add to that, being a person of color.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Police in Indianapolis have spent this day looking for answers after a gunman shot 8 people to death and then himself. The bloodshed followed other attacks nationwide, prompting President Biden to call it, quote, a national embarrassment. It also stunned a city hard hit by gun violence. Indianapolis today is enveloped in grief, already reeling from a recent series of mass shootings. Last night, it became the site of the nation's latest attack.
So this morning, for the third time since January, our community woke up to news of a senseless crime that will not soon leave our memory.
Police said just after 11 p.m., 19-year-old Brandon Scott Hull drove to a FedEx operations center near the Indianapolis airport and opened fire with a rifle. He was a former employee at the facility.
There was no confrontation with anyone that was there. There was no disturbance. There was no argument. He just appeared to randomly start shooting.
Police said the gunman began shooting in the parking lot before moving inside the facility. The entire attack lasted a matter of minutes. One witness said he heard pops that didn't sound like gunfire until it intensified.
Then more shots went off. Somebody went behind their car to the trunk and got another gun, and then I saw one body on the floor.
Police say the gunman killed himself before they arrived on the scene and say they don't yet have a motive. Police also said a significant number of the employees at the facility are members of the Sikh community. A Sikh civil rights organization said members of the community were among the wounded and dead. Relatives are still waiting for victims to be identified. In a statement, FedEx offered condolences to the families of those killed and said it would cooperate with the investigation. Today, the Indianapolis mayor called for national efforts to stop gun violence. 8 people were killed in 2 separate shootings in the city this year before last night's attack.
The process of healing will take time, but I think healing does depend on meaningful conversations between people about how we stop this cycle of violence that's driven by readily accessible guns.
In Washington, President Biden echoed that message. He called on Congress to pass legislation implementing universal background checks and banning high-capacity magazines. In a statement, he said too many Americans are dying every single day from gun violence. It stains our character and pierces the very soul of our nation. The White House today also lowered its flags to half staff to honor the victims. Late today, Indianapolis police said they seized a gun from the suspected shooter last year and that the FBI interviewed him after police made a mental health call to his home.
Meanwhile, a police officer in San Antonio killed two people during a traffic stop today. An exchange of gunfire came after police pulled over a truck with three people inside. Police said body camera footage shows the officer having a conversation with the driver, who then pulled out a gun and shot the officer in the hand. The officer returned fire, killing the driver and the front seat passenger. A third passenger was injured. Questions over a different fatal shooting and the role of the police are front and center in Chicago. There, the mayor, city officials, and community leaders are taking stock of how police respond with force and whether more changes are needed. Stephanie Tsai begins with this report and a warning. This story contains graphic video.
Chicago sits on edge as protests have broken out over the police killing of 13-year-old Adam Toledo.
We constantly burying our kids, and there's no justice being served. What do they want us to do?
Business owners along the city's Magnificent Mile began boarding up windows as city officials called for calm. Toledo lived with his family on Chicago's west side. The last moments of his life are now under investigation. On Thursday, this graphic video from Chicago police officer Eric Stillman's body camera was released from the night of March 29th. The 9 minutes of footage show Officer Stillman chasing Toledo down an alley. He was with a 21-year-old man who police say fired a gun. Toledo can be seen fleeing as Officer Stillman yells for the teenager to stop and show his hands. Toledo then turns around. From another video, he appears to make a throwing motion in a direction where officers say this gun was later recovered. But then he raises his hands. The officer fires one shot, killing the seventh grader.
He put his hands up and was still murdered. So I have a question. What more could he have done?
Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot called the video excruciating to watch, but called on protesters to remain peaceful as the incident is investigated.
While we don't have enough information to be the judge and jury of this particular situation, it is certainly understandable why so many of our residents are feeling an all too familiar surge of outrage and pain. And it's even clearer that trust between our communities and law enforcement is far from healed and remains badly broken.
Previous police shooting videos that have gone public sparked major protests in Chicago, including one in 2015 that showed a white officer shooting 17-year-old Laquan McDonald 16 times. Today, another mother grieves. Elizabeth Toledo described Adam as a curious and goofy teenager who loved animals, riding his bike, and junk food. The Toledo family issued a statement urging people to avoid violent protests. Protests that have erupted time and again as the nation continues to grapple with how to check police use of lethal force.
Let's look further at some of the questions raised by this case and similar questions other cities around the country are facing. Hans Menos is the vice president of law enforcement initiatives for the Center for Policing Equity. He served previously as the executive director of the Police Advisory Commission for the city of Philadelphia. Mr. Menos, thank you so much for joining us on the NewsHour. I think most everyone would agree it is simply unacceptable for a 13-year-old to be shot and killed by a police officer. But when you look at that video, is there nuance that needs to be discussed and explored?
So first, thank you for having me. And, you know, my heart goes out to the Toledo family. I honestly can't imagine as a father and as a parent having to watch that video of a child of your child on a regular basis. So yeah, of course there's nuance. There's nuance in everything. I think what we have to start with is the idea that Adam Toledo was a 13-year-old boy, and we failed him. If his death is not wholly his responsibility, it's on us as the adults to prevent these issues from occurring. So we're gonna find out. There will be an investigation. There's an ongoing investigation. But some of the things we have to keep in mind are that the evidence that has been presented so far has been presented by the police department. It has been done in a light that needs to be brought objectively. And so we know that's happening. The Chicago Civilian Office of Police Accountability is investigating, and we should all wait to see what pans out there.
So we are hearing sort of the police side of things as you described it, but we also have seen video from at least two angles. And we know that the officer was running after Adam Toledo and another adult who has been charged. Let me ask you how that pursuit on foot could have led to this situation, and could it have been avoided?
So this is a great question, an ongoing question, I think, around the country as well in the actual city of Chicago. Is the foot pursuit policy sufficient? The answer is we don't really know because there's no foot pursuit policy. So what can officers do to prevent the discharge of their firearm? What practices can they employ? How can they keep themselves safe and keep other people safe by drafting, writing, vetting a foot pursuit policy that guides their practice? Without that, what we have is officers doing what they think is right in the heat of a moment, and that can have disastrous consequences.
We know that the Chicago Police Department has a troubled history of firing their weapons, and disproportionately so on Black and brown men. Do you think this fatal shooting of Adam Toledo fit a pattern we've seen before with other victims?
Well, yes. I think that police shootings overall, when we see the history of this country, not just Chicago, they affect Black and brown young men. And I'll highlight that other much more egregious, much older white men have managed to live through their offenses. Dylan Roof, Kyle Rittenhouse, Robert Lang, three of the more recent egregious shooters, killing many people, 17 to 18 people, have lived through this experience and were brought to justice. We're never going to know what Adam Toledo might say in his defense, because he was killed on the streets. And so that's significant. And I think community draws this comparison. It's not lost on community that Black and brown young kids are dying at the hands of police while white kids are being brought to trial and being brought to the normal path of justice.
Hans Menos with the Center for Policing Equity, thank you so much for joining us with your perspective.
Thank you for having me.
In the day's other news, the U.S. Justice Department is getting back into the business of policing local police. Attorney General Merrick Garland today rescinded a Trump-era curb on consent decrees. That will make it easier to investigate police departments and press for major changes in use of force and other policies. An Indiana man has become the first person to plead guilty to federal charges in the January assault on the U.S. Capitol. John Ryan Schaefer is a heavy metal guitarist and a member of the far-right Oath Keepers militia. He pled to charges that stem from storming the Capitol and using bear spray on police. On the pandemic, the World Health Organization chief reports COVID-19 infections are nearing the highest rate yet. India recorded another 217,000 cases in just 24 hours, and the number of deaths worldwide closed in on 3 million. In Washington, public health leaders warned again of surges nationwide.
Some of these increases are as a result of relaxed prevention efforts in states across the country, such as relaxed mask mandates or loosened restrictions on indoor restaurant seating. Another reason for these increases is the continued spread of highly transmissible variants, more than 50 to 70% more transmissible.
The Biden administration also announced that it's providing $1.7 billion to help track and identify variants of the virus. Russia responded to new U.S. sanctions today with penalties of its own. On Thursday, Washington ousted 10 Russian diplomats and imposed other measures, citing interference in the U.S. election and hacking of federal agencies. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov answered in Moscow.
You said 10 diplomats were included in the list. We will respond reciprocally to this measure. We will propose 10 diplomats of the United States to the Russian Federation to leave our country.
In addition, 8 current and former U.S. officials are banned from entering Russia, including the FBI director and the attorney general. Iran has begun enriching small amounts of uranium to 60%, its highest level yet. Today's announcement is still well short of the 90% level that's needed for weapons-grade uranium. In Washington, President Biden criticized the move at a White House news conference after meeting with Japan's Prime Minister Suga.
We do not support and do not think it's at all helpful that Iran is saying it's going to move to enrich to 60%. It is contrary to the agreement.
Iran's announcement came as U.S. and Iranian negotiators are holding indirect talks in Vienna on resurrecting the 2015 nuclear deal. A court in Hong Kong sentenced 9 pro-democracy leaders today over a mass anti-government march in 2019. It was mainland China's effort to suppress the protest movement. Media tycoon Jimmy Lai was ordered to serve up to 18 months in prison. 82-year-old former lawmaker Martin Li had his sentence suspended. In Cuba, Raul Castro made it official today. He is stepping down after 10 years as leader of that country's ruling Communist Party. He made the announcement at a party congress. It marks a transition to a younger generation of communist officials. Raul Castro is 89. He had succeeded his brother Fidel, who led the 1959 revolution and died 5 years ago. Back in this country, a watchdog report finds former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo repeatedly violated ethics rules. The State Department's Inspector General says that Pompeo and his wife asked aides to carry out personal tasks more than 100 times. They ranged from handling pet care to mailing Christmas cards. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 164 points to close at another record, 34,200. The NASDAQ rose 13 points, and the S&P 500 added 15, also reaching a new record. Still to come on the NewsHour, the Biden administration reverses course twice in one day on the issue of refugees. Multiple states seek to ban young transgender athletes from competition. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart consider the week's political news, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today saw the Biden administration giving mixed messages on whether it would leave historically low caps on refugees put in place by former President Trump. Yamiche Alcindor has more.
President Biden walked back an earlier promise to raise the cap on the number of refugees allowed into the United States. I'm joined now by Jenny Yang. She is the Vice President of Advocacy and Policy at World Relief, a humanitarian nonprofit. Jenny Yang, thanks so much for joining us. Just walk us through what happened today with these twists and turns on the refugee cap.
Well, earlier today, the president signed a presidential determination that basically kept the low refugee cap of 15,000 for the U.S. refugee admissions program. And this is a number that was previously set by President Trump, but which President Biden himself decided to keep. Now, the one change he did make was to revise the program to expand the categories through which refugees are actually eligible to come in through the program. But the fact that he kept the refugee ceiling at the historically low level of 15,000 is very, very concerning, because it does mean that refugees will continue to be excluded from the program, even though many of them have been waiting many, many years to come in. Now, the White House just recently issued a statement saying that 15,000 is not the final number for this fiscal year. But it's very, very concerning because the president himself said that he would actually raise the refugee ceiling to 62,500. And we're still waiting for him to follow through on that commitment.
Talk about the impact this has on the lives of migrants who are waiting to try to come to the United States as refugees.
Well, refugees is a very small subset of the larger immigrant population, in that you have to have a well-founded fear of persecution on the account of your race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. And once you meet that definition, you're referred to the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program. And at a time when we're facing the world's worst refugee crisis, the U.S. resettles less than half of 1% of the world's refugees, which means that this very narrow lifeline of protection needs to be not only preserved, but expanded to really help those individuals who cannot go home or locally integrate. Historically, the United States has had a refugee ceiling on average of 95,000 refugees per year. So the fact that the refugee ceiling is 15,000 means that it's not only the lowest number ever set in the history of the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, but it effectively shuts out many deserving refugees from being able to be reunited with their loved ones in the United States. And just as an example, one of our staff members, Bazuze, is from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and he was resettled several years ago, but his brother has been waiting for his wife to be reunited with him. And she was on a flight to come to the United States. So she sold all of her belongings and was waiting to board a flight when the flight was canceled because the president didn't sign the necessary paperwork to revise the ceiling. And so she actually had to go back into the refugee camp where she is right now. And we still don't know yet if she'll be rebooked to come to the United States.
And lastly, with only the few seconds we have left here, the Biden administration was saying that this had to be kept lower because of the surge at the border. What do you make of that argument?
That is not a good reasoning, because the Refugee Admissions Program is run by the State Department. They have a completely different funding stream, and agencies like World Relief and other resettlement agencies are prepared and necessary to actually welcome refugees. The issue at hand is not capacity or resources. It's ultimately a matter of political will and the courage to actually up the refugee ceiling to actually help those who really have nowhere else to go.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jenny Yang of World Relief.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been a record-breaking year of bills proposed in state legislatures that would limit transgender rights, from access to medical care to sports participation. Despite that, a new PBS NewsHour NPR Marist poll found that Americans across the political spectrum oppose those efforts, and more than half of people personally know someone who is transgender. John Yang has our report.
Late afternoon in Boise, Idaho, and Lindsay Hecox is doing what she loves most. A track and cross-country runner in high school, Hecox, now 20 years old, dreams of running for Boise State University, where she's a student.
I don't know how I would have gotten through high school if I didn't have my running teams. They were my only friend group. I kind of just feel like I need friendship through running again.
For most teenagers, going from high school to college is a big step. But for Hecox, it was a major life change. She came out as transgender, meaning her gender identity does not align with the sex she was assigned at birth, a condition known as gender dysphoria.
Gender dysphoria just sucks. You don't get to be the person you were meant to be just because of some random luck when you were born. I'm able to deal with struggles in life a lot better now just because I've already gotten through this.
As her transition and college began, she found herself at the center of a political firestorm.
All female athletes want is a fair shot at competition. But what if that shot was taken away by a competitor who claims to be a girl but was born a boy?
Opportunities for women are being shoved aside for a new priority, transgender athletes.
Last year, Idaho became the first state in the nation to ban transgender women and girls from competing on all female sports teams.
House Bill number 500 just passed the House.
Hecox, who had begun her transition not even a year earlier, was at the state capitol speaking out.
I think I'm rightfully pissed off that they word it so that I'm othered and made different when it doesn't need to be that way.
After Idaho's Republican governor, Brad Little, signed the measure, Hecox sued, and a federal judge blocked the law from taking effect. In the years since, three more states, Mississippi, Tennessee, and Arkansas, have enacted similar bans. It's part of a sweeping trend. More than 60 such laws proposed in nearly 30 states this year alone, according to the Human Rights Campaign, an LGBTQ advocacy group.
This seems to be yet another in the list along party lines of the kind of cultural clashes we've seen where Democrats are on one side of the fence and Republicans on the other side.
Lee Meringoff is the director of the Marist College Institute for Public Opinion.
That the Republicans are, you know, saying, all right, we're going to talk to our cultural base here, and we're not going to worry about the broader public opinion.
I'm calling from Marist College. We're talking to people in your community and collecting...
A PBS NewsHour NPR Marist poll released today found Americans split on whether transgender athletes should be allowed to play on high school teams. But among Republicans, an overwhelming majority said they should not. However, when asked whether they should be banned by law, a large majority of both Republicans and Democrats said no.
They don't want to legislate. They don't want to go to that level of extreme views or actions in their own minds.
I'm not a politician. I'm a pediatrician.
For transgender youth and their physicians, like Robert Garofalo at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago, the effect of these bills could be very personal.
My understanding of legislation is that we legislate things that are problems. This is legislation in search of a problem.
The NCAA allows transgender athletes to compete on single-sex teams after a year of hormone therapy. Neither they nor state high school athletic associations keep track of the number of transgender competitors. But a recent Associated Press analysis found only a handful of instances among the hundreds of thousands of students playing high school sports. Those backing the ban say transgender females have an unfair advantage. Connecticut allowed transgender high school athletes beginning in 2017. Last year, four female track team members sued, saying that just two transgender runners had won titles that had been held by nine different female athletes.
I was forced to compete against biological males. Girls across Connecticut and New England all knew the outcome of our races long before the start, and it was extremely demoralizing.
Most medical experts, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, say there's no scientific or medical evidence that transgender female athletes inherently have an edge.
We're not legislating sports participation based on the size of your shoe or based upon your height or other sort of immutable characteristics.
In fact, Heacock says she noticed a difference the moment she transitioned.
Minutes are now gone from what I would be able to do in a 5K. I'll feel like I can't go as longer, so stamina, my muscles will give out. I'll need to stop quicker.
Dr. Garofalo says excluding transgender youth from athletics could be devastating for them, recalling his own teen years.
Sports participation, especially in high school or junior high school, is much broader than whether you win or lose. If you would have told me when I was 17 that I couldn't play on the soccer team or I couldn't play on the tennis team, so much of my self-esteem, so much of what I pinned my self-worth as a teenager would have been erased or eradicated.
Heacock hopes that public opinion will continue to shift in favor of transgender rights as more people hear stories like hers.
Things will get better. This legislation is just a momentary setback for trans acceptance.
What would you say to your high school self?
Yeah, I would say that even though this is hard, I don't want to just fade from the world and not have any impact on it. I'm on the leading edge of this, like, last frontier is trans people. It's really awesome. So high school self, be happy that you got this opportunity and keep fighting.
Fighting both in the courts and on the track for a slot on the team. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
And the analysis of Brooks and Capehart, that is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. Hello to both of you. Very good to see you on this Friday night. But I want to start out with something that has been less than uplifting this week, and that is more gun violence, in particular two more police shootings of young black men, different circumstances, one in Minneapolis, just 10 miles from where the man who's accused of murdering George Floyd is on trial, the other one in Chicago. Jonathan, my question is, we keep seeing this happen. What do we make of it? And is it something that is going to require a change in law?
It's going to require a change in a lot of things, Judy. It's going to require a change in law, certainly, but a change in attitudes among the American people as a whole and among police. You know, when I leave my home, when I leave my apartment, I know that when I am no longer at home, I am viewed with some level of suspicion, even as a threat, simply because I'm Black and certainly because I am a Black male. And that is something that I have to deal with. And, you know, I've said often and I'll keep saying it, there's no such thing as a routine traffic stop when you're African-American, and particularly when you're an African-American man. And I think attitudes need to change, particularly among police, because more often than not, we are viewed as threats. We saw that in the video of Army Lieutenant Nazario in Virginia that happened in December, but came to light last week. We saw that in the video of the initial encounter with George Floyd. When they tapped on the window of George Floyd's SUV with the flashlight, he turns around and what does he see? A gun in his face. With Dante Wright in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. The police officer said, I'll tase you, taser, taser, taser. Instead, she had a gun in her hand and shot him. Now, as you said, Judy, these are all different circumstances, but the overall mood is the same. Black people feel under threat. They feel under siege. Until the rest of America changes its attitude, and until law enforcement somehow changes the way it views the people they are sworn to serve and protect, nothing is going to change.
David, why does this keep happening, and what do you think about what needs to change?
Well, the first thing that needs to change is we do need to accept that there is racial bias in policing. There are still too many people, and especially too many people in the police force, who think it's not there. But it's not only Jonathan's experience and almost every experience of every African-American person I know. There's just dozens of studies that show in traffic stops, car searches, drug arrests, there's just vast disparate policing. So that still goes on, and that's just about attitude. The good news is, you know, if you do take some reforms, you can make some progress. There's been a sharp drop in the number of shootings of unarmed people. Armed people, it's still pretty stable, but unarmed people, we've made some progress. So there are things that can be done. And those are things like removing chokeholds. Those are things like a little idea that I kind of like is you have to have written permission to search a car. So these things called pretextual stops, where they stop a car on the pretext of one thing when they're really looking for something else. Data is very poorly collected. So which parts of which police forces are having the most disparate arrests or the most disparate searches? That data is not collected. There are these things called the Police Officers' Bill of Rights, which are in a lot of state legislatures that police unions have instituted, that create all these artificial barriers to investigating an incident, that a cop has to be punished within 30 or 100 days, and if it's too late, then he's off. And so there are lots of little things that can be done to hopefully reduce these kinds of tragedies.
And Jonathan, are these the kinds of things that you think can make a difference? What can we be trying that hasn't been tried before now?
Well, actually, all of those things that David just mentioned are pieces of what is known as the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. And I think that if that does become law, that it will start to put us on a road of ameliorating this very severe problem. But also, it's a problem that is not just now part of contemporary America. Generations of African Americans have been talking about this and complaining about this. And the one thing that is different is that a lot of this has been caught on video. And so if you do have things like ending racial profiling, collecting data, ending qualified immunity, which makes it possible for people to hold police officers and police departments accountable when they get it wrong. Those are all things that will improve policing, excuse me, but will also improve the relationship between communities and police, because anyone who thinks that African Americans don't want protection from crime and don't want police to actually be there to serve and protect, they are suffering under a very wrong notion.
And David, I should say I misspoke. I said the shooting of two young Black men, one was a young Black man, the other was a young a teenager, Latino, who was 13 years old. But David, do you think these measures can make a difference?
Yeah, I think they have. I think our policing has improved from where it was. I was briefly a police reporter on the south and west side of Chicago. And there was an atmosphere then, maybe there still is, but I think it's probably less, of it's us first in the world. The we cops are the good guys, and the world is an awful place. And so there was almost a military attitude. And that military culture is something experts talk about in the training of policing. And that's just not the right attitude. And the hard part about this is there are like, I think 18,000 police forces in this country. It's hyper-local. A lot of them are under-resourced. A lot have their own cultures. But changing that culture so that people are out in the neighborhood, I think, has helped. And getting diverse workforces has helped a bit. So this has been awful to watch these things, but it's not like it's not something we haven't made some progress toward.
Something else I want to ask both of you about, the decision by President Biden, Jonathan, to pull all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan by September 11th. It will have been 20 years since the United States was attacked, of course, by Al-Qaeda. The president's argument is that this was never meant to be a war that lasted this long, in his words, a multi-generational war. And he also made the argument, we don't need, the threat has metastasized around the world, and we can't fight it any longer with boots on the ground in one country. What do you make of his argument and of the decision?
I think his argument is one that we should take seriously and one that we need to deal with. Yes, the threat has metastasized around the world, and it isn't just coming out of Afghanistan. And it does make sense to remove our troops and have them nimble enough to respond to those. And let's keep in mind, there are 10,000 NATO troops in Afghanistan. 2,500 of them are U.S. troops. So we're not talking about the 100,000 troops on the ground as we had in 2011. So this is an easier lift. But the other thing to keep in mind is the number of people who have cycled through there. I have some stats here. 30,000, 2,300 dead, 20,000 wounded, 30,000 U.S. service members have been deployed to Afghanistan at least 5 times. And we're talking about not a broadly shared sacrifice. We're talking about a narrowly shared sacrifice, and not even shared at all, when you have 1% of the American population serving in the military. So this was not an easy decision, I would think, for the president. But the fact that he made it and said and set a deadline, which is very controversial, but he wants the United States out. And I give him credit for making a very tough decision.
And David, what's your thinking on this?
Yeah, I disagree. I think it's a grave mistake. I think every expert that I read, or at least most of them, seem to believe that the Taliban will take over Afghanistan, will take over Kabul and the major cities. And that's not going to be good for girls who want to go to school. That's not good for people who want to enjoy a life of freedom. That's a return to something pretty ugly. We have only 2,500 there, but they're protecting the 10,000. The other NATO troops who are doing most of the training, our men and women in uniform, are not on frontline combat by and large anymore. And so it's not as onerous a lift as it was before. And to preserve a somewhat free society, I think is the right thing to do. If the U.S. pulls out, all the other NATO forces are expected to pull out, and then we'll be back. And I understand the impatience. It's been 20 years, but we've been in North Korea in South Korea a long time. We've been in Europe a long time. I think these things can sometimes serve a use, and say that while saluting the sacrifice of the people who go over there.
Just briefly, Jonathan, what do you say to this argument? It's leaving a lot of people in the lurch in Afghanistan.
Well, no, I understand that argument, and David makes a very good point that we, Afghan women and girls probably face danger. Afghanistan could collapse, but could and might not assured. And so, like I said, this was not an easy decision. In some ways, it's a gamble, but I think it's one that the president felt he had to make.
David?
Yeah, listen, we're not going to be the world's policeman anymore. We're not going to be the kind of superpower we were after the aftermath of World War II. But we still are the biggest power in the world. And I think with that comes opportunities to try to preserve civilization when you can. And that doesn't mean going to war. That doesn't mean putting our men and women in combat. But guarding people who are training the Afghan soldiers to go into combat, that seems to me a right balance to strike.
Sobering stuff at the end of this week. David Brooks, Jonathan Capehart, thank you both.
Thanks, Judy.
Thank you, Judy.
As we do every week, we take time now to commemorate the lives of five people lost to COVID-19, as remembered by their loved ones. Ronald Verrier's loud, strong laugh gave comfort to his patients at St. Barnabas Hospital in the Bronx, New York, where he worked as a surgeon. His colleagues remembered him as a rare combination, a good brain, good hands, and a good heart. Born in Haiti, Ronald rushed back when the 2010 earthquake struck to volunteer however he could. His sister said that was who the 59-year-old was. Always the first to help. Elizabeth Massman, or Betty to her family and friends, moved some 26 times in her early life, and her daughter said she made lasting connections wherever she went. She pursued her education while her children were growing up and became a school nurse and later an advocate for children in need. Her daughter said 91-year-old Betty was the family's rock, and never lost her love of adventure, traveling the world, hiking, and cycling well into her later years. Tony Murray's husband, Mark, remembered knowing he was the one from the day they met at an educators conference in 1995. He said Tony was a great cook, famous for preparing enough ribs and fried fish to feed an army. He worked for the YMCA in New York City, where he loved working with children on concerts and plays. Tony became a mentor to his nephew, Jason Collins, the first openly gay NBA player, and walked beside Jason in Boston's Gay Pride Parade. Tony was 60 years old. Bob Green was a true Montana cowboy, his family remembered, with a gruff exterior, but a soft heart and a presence you could always count on. After four tours in Vietnam with the Navy, the wide open spaces of his native state called him home again. Bob, who lived to be 83, took pride in tending to the green spaces in their small community of Trout Creek. And his dream was to build a playground there for children to enjoy. The community will build that playground this year and name it after Bob Green. Pastor David Gilmore radiated kindness from his pulpit at New Mount Zion Baptist Church in Baltimore. He was active in the church all his life. It's where he met his wife, Leah, when they were young. Leah described his presence as Santa Claus 365 days a year, a jolly guy with a beard. She said she sees the qualities she treasured most in him embodied in his two sons. David was 59. And our thanks to family members for sharing these stories with us. Our hearts go out to you, as they do to everyone who's lost a loved one in this pandemic. This weekend, Mickey Guyton will become the first Black woman to co-host the Academy of Country Music Awards. She was the only Black woman to be nominated for an award this year. But as Amna Nawaz reports, a number of Black women are starting to gain traction in the genre. It's part of our ongoing arts and culture coverage, Canvas.
Like my good, just ain't good enough. My honest ain't true enough. When Brittany Spencer released the first single from her debut EP last summer, she didn't know what to expect.
Honestly, I didn't know that anyone would listen to this project. I just thought that I was putting out something on all the streaming services to be able to send whenever I pitch myself for a 2 a.m. slot at a festival or something. And so much more has happened. You can hold
my hand. In October, Spencer tweeted out her cover of a song by country supergroup The High Women. A month later, she said she was floored when group member Maren Morris sent her a shout out from the Country Music Awards stage.
Brittany Spencer, Rhiannon Giddens, there are so many amazing Black women that pioneered and continue to pioneer this genre.
Since then, Spencer's song Compassion, which tackles issues of racial justice, has been streamed more than 3.5 million times on Spotify.
It's been such a wild ride. I'm honestly just living in a constant state of gratitude because so many people have embraced me.
Singers like Brittany Spencer, Tierra, Chapel Heart, Raina Roberts, Miko Marx, long excluded from country music, are now breaking through and finding audiences flocking to their music.
Things are changing. You know, people want to see a different Nashville.
Shannon Sanders is executive director of creative at BMI and has been in the industry for more than 25 years. He says the death of George Floyd last May, combined with the COVID-19 pandemic, created a defining moment for the nation and for Nashville.
People were forced to be still. People were forced to pay attention. America especially had time to just stop, look at itself, and realize what was going on.
What was going on in country music was that people of color, especially women, were being kept out. A recent study from the University of Ottawa found that women of color represent less than 1% of artists signed to a major label. And over the last 20 years, Black women accounted for 0.03% of all music played on country radio.
There's already the issue of women not necessarily getting the same airplay as male artists. Add to that being a person of color. Show the world.
You're a country girl. In 2007, Recy Palmer's song Country Girl made it on the Billboard charts, but staying on top was a different story.
How hard has it been since then to get a song back on the charts?
Oh, I don't even try. The thing that people don't understand is how much it costs to even do this. I think that's part of the reason why there hasn't been a huge presence of people of color, because you have to have backing to do this.
That's why Palmer is trying to help other artists get recognition outside of the typical avenues. She hosts a show on Apple Music called Color Me Country, a name that pays tribute to Black country singer Linda Martell's 1970 album. And Palmer created a fund that gives small grants to independent artists of color.
The industry has had how many years to make all these things happen, and they haven't? And so I think if I can do this, Lil Recy Palmer, then... you know, what are y'all doing? What are y'all with all the millions of dollars? Like, what are you doing? Like, what can you do? And I hope that it inspires them and it makes them make changes.
In the meantime, Black female country artists are bootstrapping their own careers, collaborating with each other, and reaching fans directly through social media and streaming platforms, proving there is a market for their music.
Country music is not a white music. Country music was constructed as a white music.
Stephen Lewis is the curator of the newly opened National Museum of African American Music in Nashville. He says Black artists were integral to the creation of country music. Even the banjo was based off an African string instrument.
The reason why most people don't know about it has to do with decisions that were made in the recording industry in the 1920s. In particular, the decision to market country music, or what was then known as hillbilly music, to white consumers.
There's a lot of money being left on the floor. Just because people don't feel like they're invited to the party. Black people were at the concrete pouring, if you will, of country music and built this house and then somehow got locked out. So to have country open the door with open arms, I think we're set up for a real homecoming.
I kind of wanted to turn it around.
It's been a kind of homecoming for Julie Williams. She grew up in Tampa, and even though she'd listened to country music as a child, she didn't imagine herself becoming a country singer.
It's hard to want to go into a genre of country music when country music for me was the boys in high school blasting it out of the back of their trucks with Confederate flags on it, right? That just, it told me that this isn't a genre for me. Even when I moved to Nashville, I was hesitant to say that I was a country artist because that was not the country that I want to be a part of. But the country of Recy Palmer, Mickey Guyton, Maren Morris, right? That's the country I want to be a part of. Girls are too tight, skin is too
dark to feel beautiful. Last month, Williams took a leap of faith and released a music video for her new single, Southern Curls. With her own kind of Southern
curl. I would hope that younger Julie would see this and hear my song about my hair and my journey and know that there are other people out there that feel the same way, and so she would love herself. That's what I'm hoping.
For Brittany Spencer, it's been a journey to find her own voice too, moving to Nashville from her hometown of Baltimore several years ago.
I'm aware that there's not a lot of people in this space that look like me, and that there's a lot of people in this space who might not know how to handle someone like me.
Does that ever make you feel like, to put it bluntly, like I should be programming and singing for white people?
I think when I first moved here, I think my mind probably might have been more in that direction. But today it's not. I stopped asking the question of whether or not something I do is good enough. And I started asking, is it me enough? And that has made a world of difference in my music.
Adding her stories and her voice to the growing chorus in country music. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Amna Nawaz.
And you can see more of our arts coverage later tonight on Beyond the Canvas, presented by our own Amna Nawaz. You can check your local PBS listings. It is with sadness that we want to note a passing tonight that means a lot to us at the NewsHour. Vartan Gregorian was the president of the Carnegie Corporation of New York, founded by Andrew Carnegie in 1911. At the time, the largest philanthropic organization in the country, it is still among the largest. Earlier, Gregorian served as the president of Brown University and of the New York Public Library. Born in Iran and of Armenian descent, he went on to earn two PhDs from Stanford and later was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He remained active in supporting Armenian causes throughout his life. Several years ago, he co-founded the Aurora Prize, which honors individuals for humanitarian work on behalf of the survivors of the Armenian Genocide. The Prime Minister of Armenia called it the Armenian Nobel Prize. Vartan Gregorian and Carnegie have been longtime believers and supporters of the NewsHour. I personally mourn his loss as a dear friend and mentor, one of the most extraordinary people I have ever known. With deep sympathies to his family, we will miss him very much. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here Monday evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe and have a good weekend. Good night.